in silence. Brown and Price ran forward. The Danes held back. Brown opened the trunk of the car. There lay Gordievsky, soaked in sweat, conscious but dazed. He was semi-naked in this pool of water, and I immediately felt it was like I was seeing a newborn child in amniotic fluid and some extraordinary rebirth. Gordievsky was momentarily dazzled by the sunlight. All he could see was blue sky, clouds, and trees. He staggered out and onto his feet, helped by Brown. Veronica Price did not approve of emotional displays, but she was visibly moved, her expression a mixture of recognition and love. She wagged her finger in mock admonition, as if to say, "Gosh, you really have been up to something." Gordievsky seized both her hands, raised them to her lips, and kissed them, an unmistakably Russian gesture of gratitude and liberation. Then he walked shakily over to where Caroline Ascot and Rachel G. stood side by side. Bowing from the waist, he kissed their hands too, first one and then the other. All we had seen was this great bull coming out of the bushes, and then suddenly there was this courteous, very delicate gesture. The space blanket was still draped over his shoulders. He looked like an athlete who had just run a marathon. Veronica Price took his arm and gently guided him away, a dozen yards into the forest, out of range of any microphones in the British cars. Now, at last, he spoke, addressing her by the alias she had always worn. "Jean, I was betrayed." There was no time for more. At the second rendezvous point, Gordievsky was swiftly dressed in fresh clothing. His dirty clothes, shoes, bag, and Soviet papers were bundled up and placed in the trunk of Shawford's car, along with the false passports for Layla and the girls, the redundant syringes, and clothes. Price took the wheel of the Finnish rental car, while Brown and Gordievsky climbed into the back seat. She turned onto the highway, heading north. Gordievsky waved away the sandwiches and fruit juice Price had carefully packed. "I wanted whiskey," he said later. "Why didn't they give me whiskey?" Brown had expected him to be hysterical with exhaustion, but instead, Gordievsky seemed perfectly controlled. He began to tell his story, describing the drugged interrogation, how he had evaded surveillance, and the mysterious way the KGB had followed but not arrested him. As soon as he was able to talk, he was straight into analysis of the case and how he'd misjudged it. Brown gently raised the question of his family. "It was too much of a risk to bring them," Gordievsky said flatly, and stared out of the window at the passing Finnish countryside. At the petrol station on the road to Helsinki, Shawford met Ascot and G, heard a swift account of the escape, and headed for the telephone box. The phone rang on P5's desk in Century House. The entire Pimlico team clustered around the desk. The SovBlock controller snatched up the receiver. "How is the weather?" he asked. "The weather's excellent," said Shawford, and the SovBlock's controller repeated the words to the team clustered around the desk. "The fishing has been very good. The sun is shining. We have one extra guest." The message caused momentary confusion. Did that mean another escapee, in addition to the four family members? Had Gordievsky brought along someone else? Were there five people heading for Norway, and if so, how would the guest get across the border without a passport? Shawford repeated, "No, we have one guest, in total." The team whooped in unison as the call ended, but the joy was uneven. Sarah Page, the MI6 secretary who had done so much to maintain the nuts and bolts of the case, and was now 6 months pregnant, felt a lurch of empathy for Layla and the children. "Oh, the poor wife, and his daughters," she thought. "They have been left behind. What will happen to them?" She turned to another secretary and muttered, "What about the human cost?" P5 called C. C called Downing Street. Charles Powell told Margaret Thatcher. The SovBlock controller drove to Chevening House, the Foreign Secretary's country residence in Kent, to inform Geoffrey Howe that Gordievsky had crossed the Russian border. At the last moment, he decided not to take champagne. A wise decision, for Geoffrey Howe, who had never been fully behind Pimlico, was not in a celebratory mood. He had a large map of Finland spread out on a table. The MI6 man pointed to the road where Gordievsky must now be travelling north. What are your plans in the eventuality that a KGB hit squad is on his trail? Asked the foreign secretary. What if it goes wrong? What about the Finns? That night, on the top floor of the Klaus Kurki, the smartest hotel in Helsinki, Shawford hosted a dinner for the MI6 exfiltration team. They dined on roasted ptarmigan and claret. For the first time, out of microphone range, the Moscow MI6 staff discovered Pimlico's real name and what he had done. If the KGB was still watching, they would have noticed that Rachel G's bad back had miraculously recovered. The two escape cars drove on through the night, heading toward the Arctic Circle. They stopped only briefly, to fill up with gas and, once, to allow Gordievsky to shave off 3 days of stubble in a mountain stream, using a side-view mirror. He got halfway through shaving before the mosquitoes drove him back to the car. We were still in semi-hostile territory. The Russians could have mounted something if they wanted to. It was perfectly within their capabilities. But the further we got from the border, the more confident we became. The Danish pet officers stuck close. The Arctic sun dipped briefly below the horizon and then rose again. Gordievsky dozed, half awake and semi-bearded, and barely spoke. Shortly after 8 o'clock on Sunday morning, they reached the Finnish-Norwegian border at Karikasniemi, a single pole barrier across the road. The border guard barely bothered to examine the 3 Danish and 2 British passports before waving the cars through. At Hammerfest, they spent the night in an airport hotel. No one paid much attention to Mr. Hansen, the rather tired-looking Danish gentleman, and his British friends, who boarded the flight to Oslo the next morning and then caught the connecting flight to London. On Monday evening, Gordievsky found himself in South Ormsby Hall, a grand country house in the Lincolnshire Wolds, surrounded by servants, candlelight, splendid panelled rooms, and admiring people, eager to congratulate him. The seat of the Massingbird Mundy family since 1638, the hall had 3,000 acres of surrounding parkland, and a complete absence of inquisitive neighbours. Its owner, Adrian Massingbird Mundy, was an MI5 contact and happy to host a welcoming reception for an honoured guest of the service. He was staggered to be told who his guest really was, and sent an aged retainer on a bicycle into the nearby village to hang around the pub and check for any signs of loose talk. Just 48 hours earlier, Gordievsky had been lying in the trunk of a car, drugged, half-naked, drenched in his own sweat, sick with fear. Now he was being waited on by a butler. The contrast was too much. He asked if he could telephone his wife back in Russia. MI6 told him he could not. A call would alert the KGB that he was in Britain, something the British wanted to reveal only when they were good and ready. Exhausted, anxious, wondering why he had been taken to this English palace in the middle of nowhere, Gordievsky retired to a 4-poster bed. That evening, MI6 sent a telegram to the Finnish spy chief, Seppo Titinen, explaining that British intelligence officers had smuggled a Soviet defector to the West via Finland. The message came back, Seppo is content, but he wants to know if force was used. The exfiltration, MI6 reassured him, had been completed without recourse to violence. The consequences, fallout and benefits from Britain's most successful Cold War spy case began to be felt long before news broke of Gordievsky's astonishing escape. After a day in Helsinki, during which G's car was thoroughly cleaned to try to remove any evidence that Gordievsky had been in its trunk, the exfiltration team drove swiftly back to Moscow. They knew they would be declared persona non grata and thrown out of the Soviet Union as soon as the KGB uncovered what had happened. But they were elated. I've never felt such a sense of complete exhilaration, said Ascot. We were going back into the evil empire and we'd licked them. After 2.5 years of being intimidated in a system that you knew always won, we'd miraculously dodged them. David Ratford, the chargé d'affaires, performed a 5-minute jog of jubilation around the embassy. The ambassador, however, did not. A few days later, Sir Brian Cartledge formally presented his credentials to the Kremlin. A ceremonial photograph was taken, with the staff of the embassy surrounding the new ambassador, dressed in full diplomatic uniform. Ascot and G were there, fully aware, as was the ambassador, that they would not be there much longer. Mikhail Yubimov was waiting at the Zvenigorod station to meet the 11:13 train on Monday morning. But Gordievsky was not in the last carriage, nor was he on the next train from Moscow. Irritated but worried, Lyubimov returned to his dacha. Was Gordievsky lying blotto in his flat, or had something worse happened to his old friend, once so punctual and reliable? Drinking entails optionality, he reflected sadly. A few days later, Lyubimov was summoned to KGB headquarters for questioning. Rumors of Gordievsky's disappearance had begun to swirl around the KGB, accompanied by wild speculation and some deliberate misinformation. For weeks, Directorate K remained convinced that he must still be in the country, drunk or dead. A search of the Moscow area was launched, including lakes and rivers. Some said he had slipped out through Iran, using false papers and in heavy disguise. Budanov claimed that Gordievsky had been spirited into a British safe house after escaping from the KGB sanatorium, knowing full well that he had returned from Semyonovskoye weeks before his disappearance. Leyla was brought back from the Caspian and taken to Lefortovo prison for questioning. The interrogation, the first of many, continued for 8 hours. "Where is your husband?" they asked again and again. Leyla replied with asperity, "He's your officer. You tell me where he is." When the interrogators revealed that Gordievsky was suspected of working for British intelligence, she refused to believe it. "That seems so crazy to me." But as the days turned into weeks, with no word or sighting, the grim truth took root. Her husband had gone. But Leyla flatly refused to accept what she was hearing about her husband's treachery. "Until he tells me himself, I will not believe it," she told the KGB interrogators. "I was very calm. I was strong." Gordievsky had warned her not to believe any accusations made against him, so that is what she did. Gordievsky was moved from South Ormsby Hall to Fort Monkton. One MTE, standing for Military Training Establishment, the MI6 training base at Gosport. Above the gatehouse of the Napoleonic Fort, he was lodged in a guest suite, habitually used by the chief. Simple, but comfortable. Gordievsky did not want to be lauded and spoiled. He wanted to get to work and demonstrate, to himself above all, that the sacrifice had been worthwhile. Yet at first he seemed almost overwhelmed by his sense of loss. During the first 4-hour debriefing, he focused almost exclusively on the circumstances of his escape and the fate of his wife and children. He drank endless cups of strong tea and bottles of red wine, preferably Rioja. He repeatedly asked for news of his family. There was none. For the next 4 months, Fort Monkton would be his home, private, secluded, and well-defended. The need-to-know principle was strictly applied to the identity of the mystery occupant of the gatehouse. But soon many of the staff came to understand that this long-term visitor was someone of importance, to be treated as an honored guest. The case was awarded a new code name, Its Last, and one in keeping with the moment of jubilation. Sunbeam, alias Nocton, alias Pimlico, was now and henceforth Ovation. As Sunbeam, Gordievsky had supplied intelligence on the KGB's Scandinavian operations. As Nocton, in London, he had produced information that significantly affected strategic thinking in Downing Street and the White House. But as Ovation, the case would enter its most valuable phase. Much of the intelligence Gordievsky had produced over the years had been too good to be used, because it was too specific, and therefore potentially too incriminating. To protect his security, it had been chopped up, repackaged, disguised, and distributed with extreme parsimony to only the most restricted readership. During the London phase alone, the case had produced hundreds of individual reports, ranging from long documents to political reporting to detailed counterintelligence briefs, only a few of which had ever been shared outside British intelligence, and then only in edited form. Now the French could be informed of all intelligence directly relating to France. The Germans could be told of just how close the world had come to disaster during the Abel Archer scare. The full story of how Treholt, Huyck, and Berling had fallen under suspicion could be revealed to the Scandinavians. With Gordievsky now safe in Britain and the operational case ended, the vast trove of intelligence gathered over the previous 11 years could be exploited to the full. It was finally time to cash in the winnings. Britain had secrets to trade in abundance. The Fort Monckton apartment became the setting for one of the most extensive intelligence gathering, collating, and distribution exercises ever undertaken by MI6, as a succession of officers, analysts, secretaries, and others harvested the fruits of Gordievsky's espionage. With the successful exfiltration, a host of new questions arose. When should the CIA and other Western allies be told of MI6's coup? Whether to inform the media, and if so, how? And above all, how to manage relations with the Soviet Union? Would the improved understanding between Thatcher and Gorbachev, so painstakingly built up with Gordievsky's secret help, survive this dramatic turn of events in the spy war? Above all, MI6 pondered what to do about Layla and the two girls. Perhaps, with careful diplomacy, Moscow could be persuaded to release them. The sustained, intensely secret campaign to try to reunite Gordievsky with his family was codenamed Hetman, a historical term for a Cossack leader. MI6 never doubted Gordievsky's honesty, yet some found elements of his story hard to swallow. In Whitehall, a handful of skeptics wondered whether Gordievsky might have been turned into a double agent during his time in Moscow, then deliberately sent back to Britain. Why had he not been arrested and imprisoned the moment he arrived in Moscow? The analysts put that down to KGB complacency, a legalistic approach, a determination to entrap the spy and his handlers in the act, and fear. If you're in the KGB and you're going to shoot somebody, you have to have absolute proof, because it may be your turn next. They tried too hard to get hard evidence. That is what saved him, and his own sheer, desperate courage. But Gordievsky's description of being drugged and interrogated at the first chief directorate dacha seemed scarcely credible. There were doubts about the sequence of events. It just seemed so melodramatic. Finally, hanging over the entire case was the most unsettling question of all. Who had betrayed him? Confirmation that Gordievsky's story was true arrived a week later from an unexpected quarter, the KGB. On August 1st, a KGB officer named Vitaly Yurchenko walked into the U.S. Embassy in Rome and announced that he wished to defect. The Yurchenko case is one of the strangest in intelligence history. A KGB veteran of 25 years standing, General Yurchenko had risen to become head of Department 5 of Directorate K of the FCD, investigating suspected espionage by KGB officers. Additionally, he was involved in special operations abroad and the use of special drugs. In March 1985, he had become deputy chief of the First Department, responsible for coordinating KGB efforts to recruit agents in the United States and Canada. He was succeeded by Sergei Golubev, one of the men who had jointly interrogated Gordievsky. Yurchenko remained plugged into the activities of Directorate K and had good relations with Golubev. Yurchenko's motives remain murky, but his defection appears to have been spurred by a failed love affair with the wife of a Soviet diplomat. He would redefect back to the Soviet Union 4 months later for reasons that are still unclear. The Soviets later claimed he had been kidnapped by the Americans, but they were equally uncertain what to make of him. Yurchenko may have been unhinged, but he knew a number of very important secrets. Yurchenko's defection was hailed as a major triumph for the CIA, the agency's biggest KGB catch to date. The officer appointed to debrief the Russian defector was the CIA's Soviet counterintelligence expert, Aldrich Ames. At first, Ames was worried by the news of a senior KGB defector. What if Yurchenko knew he was spying for the Soviets? But it swiftly became clear that the Russian was unaware of Ames's espionage. "He didn't know anything about me," Ames said later. "If he had, I would have been one of the first persons he would have identified in Rome." Ames was waiting at Andrews Air Force Base near Washington when Yurchenko was flown in from Italy on the afternoon of August 2nd. The first thing he asked the defector, before they had even left the airport tarmac, was the question every intelligence officer is trained to ask a walk-in spy. Are there any important indications that you know of that the CIA has been penetrated by a KGB mole? Yurchenko would identify two spies inside the American intelligence establishment, including one CIA officer. But his most important revelation that very evening concerned his former colleague Oleg Gordievsky, the KGB resident in London who had been summoned back to Moscow as a suspected traitor, given a truth serum, and grilled by the investigators of Directorate K. Yurchenko had heard through the KGB grapevine that Gordievsky was now under house arrest and liable to be executed. He did not know that Gordievsky had since escaped to Britain, and nor, of course, did Ames. The Russian defector also did not know who had betrayed Gordievsky to the KGB, but Ames did. Ames's reaction to the news that Gordievsky had been arrested was indicative of a man whose parallel lives had so completely merged that he could no longer tell them apart. Ames had sold out Gordievsky to the KGB. But his first instinct, on discovering the consequences of his own action, was to warn the British that their spy was in trouble. My first thought was, Jesus Christ, we've got to do something to save him. We've got to get a cable to London and tell the Brits. I had given the KGB Gordievsky's name. I was responsible for his arrest. I was genuinely worried about him, yet at the same time I knew I had exposed him. I know that sounds crazy because I was a KGB agent too. Perhaps he was being deliberately disingenuous, or perhaps he was still only half a traitor. The CIA dispatched a message to MI6. A newly arrived Soviet defector was reporting that a senior KGB officer, Oleg Gordievsky, had been drugged and interrogated as a suspected British spy. Could MI6 shed any light? The CIA did not reveal that it knew perfectly well Gordievsky had been spying for the British. The cable from Langley came as a relief to the Ovation team. Here was independent verification of Gordievsky's story. But it also meant that the Americans would have to be told that he had escaped. Two MI6 officers flew to Washington that afternoon. At the airport, they were met by a driver and taken to Langley. Accompanied by Burton Gerber, the CIA's head of Soviet operations, they were then driven to the Maryland home of the CIA's director, Bill Casey, for an early dinner cooked by Casey's wife, Sophia. The Caseys were going to the theater later. The two British officers provided a detailed account of the Gordievsky case, from recruitment, through more than a decade of valuable service to MI6, and finally, his breathtaking escape. America also owed him an enormous debt, they explained. The Ryan intelligence, accurately reflecting Kremlin paranoia at a perilous moment in East-West relations, had come from Gordievsky. Halfway through the account, Sophia interrupted to say that it was time to leave for the theater. You go ahead, said Casey. This is the best show in town. For the rest of the evening, the American spy chief listened with admiration, gratitude, and wonder. The appreciation was entirely genuine. The surprise was not. Bill Casey did not reveal that the CIA already had a file on Gordievsky, codenamed Tickle. On September 16th, a military helicopter skimmed over the sea toward Fort Moncton. C and a handful of his senior officers were waiting by the helipad as it touched down. Out stepped Bill Casey. The veteran CIA chief had secretly flown to Britain to pick the brains of Britain's newly exfiltrated spy. A lawyer from New York, Casey knew England well from the war, when he had served in London in the Office of Strategic Services, OSS, the CIA's wartime precursor, directing spies in Europe. After running Ronald Reagan's election campaign, he was appointed to head the CIA, with responsibility, in Reagan's words, for rebuilding America's intelligence capability. A stooped figure with the face of a bloodhound, Casey was about to become embroiled in the Iran-Contra affair and would die of a brain tumor within 2 years. But at this moment, he was probably the most powerful spy in the world, with an acute appreciation of his own abilities. I'm on top of all facets of the job, he declared, early in Reagan's second term, I have a capacity to size up a situation once I get the facts and to make decisions. Casey was in Fort Moncton to get some facts from Gordievsky and make some decisions. Reagan would soon be meeting Mikhail Gorbachev for the first time at the Superpower Summit in Geneva. Casey wanted an expert KGB opinion on what he should say to the Soviet leader. Over lunch in the guest suite above the gatehouse, with only C in attendance, Casey quizzed Gordievsky about Gorbachev's negotiating style, his attitude toward the West, and his relations with the KGB. The American scribbled notes on a large yellow pad with blue lines. Occasionally, Casey's American drawl and false teeth left Gordievsky perplexed. C found himself in the odd position of having to translate American English into English English for the Russian. Casey listened attentively, like a schoolboy. Above all, the CIA's director wanted to understand Moscow's attitude toward nuclear deterrence, and in particular, the Soviet view of the Strategic Defense Initiative missile defense system. Andropov had denounced the Star Wars initiative as a deliberate attempt to destabilize the world and enable the West to attack the Soviet Union without fear of retaliation. Would Gorbachev feel the same? Casey suggested some role-playing, and an odd little Cold War drama now played out in MI6's secret training base. You are Gorbachev, he said, and I am Reagan. We would like to get rid of nuclear weapons. To inspire confidence, we will give you access to Star Wars. What do you say? In place of mutually assured destruction by nuclear weapons, Casey was effectively offering mutually assured defense against them. Gordievsky, Gorbachev, pondered for a moment, and then answered emphatically, in Russian, "Нет." Casey, Reagan, was taken aback. In his imagined exchange, the U.S. was effectively proposing to end the threat of nuclear war by sharing the technology to render it obsolete. Why "Нет"? We're giving you everything. I don't trust you. You'll never give us everything. You'll hold something back which will give you the advantage. So what do I do? If you drop SDI altogether, Moscow will believe you. That's not going to happen. Casey slipped out of character for a moment. It is President Reagan's pet project. So what should we do? All right, said Gordievsky. Then keep it up. You keep up the pressure. Gorbachev and his people know they can't outspend you. Your technology is better than theirs. Keep it up. Moscow would beggar itself trying to match Star Wars, he added, pouring money into a technological arms race it could never win. In the long term, SDI will ruin the Soviet leadership. Some historians see the meeting in Fort Moncton as another pivotal moment in the Cold War. At the Geneva summit the following November, the American president refused to budge on the Star Wars program, just as Gordievsky had advised, describing it as necessary defense. The first test of the SDI system was announced while the summit was underway, later described as the fireside summit, reflecting the warmth between the two leaders. Reagan stood firm on his pet project. Gorbachev left Geneva believing the world was a safer place, but also convinced that the USSR would have to reform, and quickly, to catch up with the West. Glasnost and perestroika followed, and then a wave of tumultuous change that, in the end, Gorbachev was powerless to control. Gordievsky's accurate interpretation of Kremlin psychology in 1985 did not cause the collapse of the Soviet Union, but it probably helped. The lunch with Bill Casey was only the first of many meetings with the CIA. Just a few months later, Gordievsky flew to Washington under tight security for a secret meeting with senior officials of the State Department, the National Security Council, the Defense Department, and the intelligence agencies. Gordievsky was bombarded with questions, which he answered patiently, professionally, and in unprecedented detail. He was no mere defector, but a long-term, deep penetration agent with an encyclopedic understanding of the KGB. The Americans were impressed and grateful. The British were proud to share the expertise of their star spy. The information from Gordievsky was very good, said Caspar Weinberger, Reagan's defense secretary. But there was one question he could not answer. Who had betrayed him? At CIA headquarters in Langley, Gordievsky was wheeled out to give a series of briefings to senior officers. At one of these, he was introduced to a tall, bespectacled man with a thin mustache, who seemed particularly friendly, quietly and patiently listening to his every word. Most CIA officers struck Gordievsky as rather formal, even a little suspicious, but this one seemed different. His face radiated gentleness and kindness. I was so impressed by him that I thought that I had encountered the embodiment of American values. Here was the openness, honesty, and decency of which I had heard so much. For a dozen years, Gordievsky had lived a double life, a dedicated professional intelligence officer who was secretly loyal to the other side, playing a part. He was very good at it, but so was Aldrich Ames. Epilogue. Passport for Pimlico. A month after Gordievsky's escape, the scientific counselor at the Soviet embassy in Paris was surprised to be invited to tea at the Alliance Française by a British diplomat he only vaguely knew. He turned up on the afternoon of August 15th to be greeted by an Englishman he had never seen before. "I have a very important message for you to give the head of your KGB station," the stranger said. The Russian turned pale. He was about to be dragged into something very murky. The Englishman calmly informed him that a senior KGB officer, until recently the resident in London, was alive and well and living in the UK under close protection. He is very happy, but he would like his family back. So began Operation Hetman, the campaign to get Layla and the girls to Britain and reunite the Gordievsky family. Within MI6, there was a debate about how to play the situation. A formal letter setting out a deal with the KGB was rejected as too risky. Any written document might have been doctored and played back at us in some way. It was agreed to deliver an oral message to a bona fide Soviet diplomat outside the UK, and the luckless counselor had been selected as the best recipient. "I've never seen a man look so frightened," said the MI6 message bearer. He went away trembling. The terms were straightforward. Thanks to Gordievsky, the British now knew the identities of every KGB and GRU officer in Britain. These would have to leave. But Moscow could withdraw people gradually over a long period, provided the Gordievsky family was set free. That way, the Kremlin would save face, its spies discreetly ejected without a diplomatic fuss, and the family would be reunited. If Moscow rejected the deal, however, and refused to release Layla and the girls, then the Soviet spies in London would be expelled en masse. The KGB had 2 weeks to respond. Gordievsky's fears for his family grew by the day. His pride at having bested the KGB was coupled with a soul-crushing guilt. The people he loved most were now prisoners of the Soviet Union. Margaret Thatcher's offer to strike a secret deal with Moscow was highly unorthodox, as Gordievsky acknowledged in a letter sent to the Prime Minister. To set aside procedures and allow the unofficial approach to go forward was a unique act of great generosity and humanity. It did not work. The offer of a secret arrangement was received in Moscow with disbelief, and then fury. In the month since Gordievsky's disappearance, the KGB had scoured the country, unwilling to believe he could have escaped. Layla was repeatedly interrogated about her husband's whereabouts, as were other members of his family, including his younger sister and mother. Marina was petrified. Olga Gordievsky was stunned. Every colleague and friend was grilled. Layla maintained a dignified front, insisting that her husband was the victim of some plot or a terrible mistake. She was tailed everywhere by 6 KGB surveillance officers. Her daughters were even watched on the school playground. Almost every day, she was hauled into Lefortovo prison for more questions. "How did you not know he was spying for the British?" they asked again and again. Finally, she snapped. "Look, let's be clear. I was a wife. My job was to clean, cook, shop, sleep with him, have children, share the bed, and be his friend. I was good at it. I'm grateful he didn't tell me anything. For 6 years of my life, I was a perfect wife. I did everything for him. You, the KGB, you have thousands of people with salaries whose job was to check up on people. They checked him and cleared him. And you come to me and blame me? Don't you think that sounds stupid? You didn't do your job. It wasn't my job, it was yours. You ruined my life. Over time, she got to know her interrogators. One day, one of the more sympathetic officers asked her, "What would you have done if you had known that your husband was planning to escape?" There was a long pause before Layla answered, "I would have let him go. I would have given him 3 days, and then, as a loyal citizen, I would have reported it. But I would have made sure he had gone for sure before I did so." The interrogator put down his pen. "I think we will not put that in the report." Layla was in enough trouble already. Mikhail Yubimov was brought in for questioning by Directorate K. "Where could he be?" they demanded. "Is he with some woman? Is he holed up in a hut somewhere in the Kursk region?" Lyubimov, of course, had no idea. "Every aspect of my relationship with Gordievsky was combed through, looking for clues to his treachery." But Lyubimov was as mystified as everyone else. "My theory was simple, and based on his appearance when I last saw him, I thought he must have had a nervous breakdown and possibly committed suicide." 10 days after the meeting in Paris, a message came back from the center, conveyed by the luckless scientific counselor in the form of a long tirade of abuse. Gordievsky was a traitor. His family would remain in Russia. There would be no deal. Britain prepared its response, Operation M-Base. In September, the Foreign Office released the news of Gordievsky's defection, though not yet the sensational details of his escape. Dramatic headlines splashed across every newspaper. "The biggest fish ever netted. Friend Oleg, master spy. Russia's ace of spies, the super spy who went west. Our man in the KGB." On the same day, the British government expelled 25 KGB and GRU officers identified by Gordievsky. A wholesale purge of Soviet spies. That day, Thatcher wrote to Ronald Reagan, "We are making it clear to the Russians, on my personal authority, that while we cannot tolerate the sort of intelligence actions which Gordievsky has revealed, we continue to desire a constructive relationship with them. In the meantime, I think it is no bad thing that he, Gorbachev, should have presented to him so starkly, early in his leadership, the price to be paid for the scale and nature of KGB activities in Western countries." Moscow's riposte was immediate. The ambassador, Sir Brian Cartledge, was summoned to the foreign ministry by Vladimir Pavlovich Suslov, head of the department responsible for dealing with foreign embassies. On the desk in front of him, Suslov had the photograph of the new ambassador surrounded by his staff. With a leaden look, he placed two fingers on the heads of Roy Ascott and Arthur G. "These two men are political bandits," he said. The KGB had begun to piece the story together. Cartledge played dumb. "What's all this about?" Suslov condemned the blatant activities of British intelligence officers in the embassy, adding that the Soviet authorities know of the role assigned in this to First Secretaries G and Ascott. Suslov was particularly enraged that Rachel G had acted the part of a woman with a bad back. He then read out the names of 25 British officials, including the two MI6 officers and their secretary, Violet Chapman, and stated they should leave the Soviet Union by the third week of October, the same deadline Mrs. Thatcher had given for the expulsion of KGB staff in London. Most of these people had nothing to do with intelligence, let alone the exfiltration. Sir Brian Cartledge met Ascott in the safe speech room and blew off steam at Gale Force 12. The ambassador knew that the Prime Minister had given her personal stamp of approval to the escape operation, but the format was only just beginning. "He was absolutely furious," recalled Ascott. "He said we had wiped out his embassy at a time when Thatcher was getting on with Gorbachev, partly because of our friends, but I couldn't tell Brian that. There are people who are most eloquent when most angry. He told me how my great-grandfather, the Prime Minister, would be turning in his grave." Actually, if Ascott's famous ancestor was doing anything in his grave, he was probably hooting with pleasure and pride. In vain, Cartledge sent a most undiplomatic telegram to London, urging an end to the tit-for-tat expulsions. "Never engage in a pissing match with a skunk. He possesses important natural advantages," he wrote. His fury rose another notch when that message found its way verbatim to the Prime Minister's desk. But Thatcher had not finished her pissing competition with the Soviets. Her cabinet secretary, Sir Robert Armstrong, proposed four more expulsions. She did not consider this adequate and insisted another six Soviet officials be thrown out. Sure enough, this prompted the immediate expulsion of six more British diplomats, bringing the overall total to 62 evictions, or 31 apiece. Cartledge's fears had been fully realized. "I lost all my Russian speakers at a stroke. We'd lost half our embassy." Gordievsky remained in hiding at the fort. Occasionally, he would leave the building and explore the surrounding area, but always under heavy protection. He took a daily jog around the fort's perimeter, or through the New Forest, accompanied by MI6 officer Martin Shawford. But he could not make any new acquaintances, or contact old friends in Britain. MI6 attempted to make this life seem almost normal, but his only social contact was with members of the intelligence community and their families. He was always busy, but deeply lonely. The separation from his own family was a perpetual torment, the complete absence of news about them a source of anguish that occasionally erupted in bitter recrimination. To overcome his misery, he threw himself into the debriefing process, insisting on working long into the night. He veered between resignation and hope, pride in what he had achieved, and despair at the personal cost. He wrote to Thatcher, "Although I had prayed for an early reunion with my wife and children, I fully accept and understand the reasons for taking decisive action. I must, however, go on hoping that some way can be found to secure the release of my family, as, without them, my life has no meaning." Thatcher replied, "Our anxiety for your family remains, and we shall not forget them. Having children of my own, I know the kind of thoughts and feelings which are going through your mind each and every day. Please do not say that life has no meaning. There is always hope." Saying that she wished to meet him one day, the Prime Minister added, "I am very conscious of your personal courage and your stand for freedom and democracy." Within the KGB, the news that Gordievsky had escaped to Britain set off a firestorm of mutual recrimination and buck-passing. Chebrikov, the KGB chief, and Kryuchkov, the head of the first chief directorate, blamed the second chief directorate, which was theoretically responsible for internal security and counterintelligence operations. The FCD bosses blamed Directorate K. Grushko blamed Gribin. Everyone blamed the surveillance team, which, since it occupied the lowest rung of the pecking order, had no one else to blame. The Leningrad KGB, responsible for surveillance of the British diplomats, was held directly accountable, and many senior officers were either sacked or demoted. Among those affected was Vladimir Putin, a product of the Leningrad KGB, who saw most of his friends, colleagues, and patrons purged as a direct consequence of Gordievsky's escape. Embarrassed and enraged, and still uncertain exactly how Gordievsky had made his getaway, the KGB responded with a campaign of disinformation, planting fake news to the effect that he had been smuggled out of the embassy during the diplomatic reception, heavily disguised, or issued false papers. His rank and importance were downplayed. The KGB would later claim, as MI6 had once claimed of Philby, that they had suspected him of disloyalty all along. In his memoirs, the former foreign minister, Yevgeny Primakov, suggested that, under interrogation, Gordievsky had offered to switch sides yet again. Gordievsky was close to confessing when he began to probe the possibility of actively operating against the British, and even offered various guarantees that he could work successfully as a double agent. The KGB leadership was informed that day. Foreign intelligence officers were confident he would admit everything the next day. But suddenly an order came from above to stop the debriefing, remove outside surveillance, and send Gordievsky to a health center. From there he fled across the Finnish border. Primakov's gloss does not make sense. If Gordievsky only came close to confessing, He plainly did not actually do so, and if he did not admit to being a British agent, how could he have offered to be a double agent? Both Primakov and Viktor Cherkashin, Ames's first KGB handler, insisted that the KGB had been alerted to Gordievsky's betrayal by an unnamed source months before his return to Moscow. But for all the bluster and fakery, the KGB leadership knew the truth. It had held the most significant spy of the Cold War in its grasp, and then let him slip through its fingers. 2 days after the Anglo-Soviet diplomatic bloodbath, a long column of passenger cars, some 20 in all, trundled along the Leningrad to Vyborg highway. 8 were British diplomatic cars, and every other car was a KGB surveillance vehicle. The diplomats were being expelled through Finland. Ascot and G were retracing the escape route. Only now they were escorted out of the country like prisoners being paraded in triumph. In his luggage, G had carefully packed a Harrods bag and a tape of Sibelius's Finlandia. As they reached the turnout with its distinctive rock, the KGB cars slowed, and the Soviet officers all swiveled in their seats and stared at the spot as they drove slowly past. They had worked it out. The KGB, legalistic to the last, had not quite finished with Gordievsky. On November 14, 1985, he was tried in absentia by a military tribunal, convicted of treason and sentenced to death. 7 years later, Leonid Shabarshin, who had succeeded Kryuchkov as head of the FCD, gave an interview in which he said he hoped Gordievsky would be assassinated in Britain and issued what sounded like a public threat to do so. Technically, he said, it's nothing very special. Oleg Gordievsky became a one-man intelligence roadshow. He traveled the world, accompanied by a series of MI6 minders, explaining the KGB and demystifying that most mysterious of organizations. Among other countries, he traveled to New Zealand, South Africa, Australia, Canada, France, West Germany, Israel, Saudi Arabia, and throughout Scandinavia. 3 months after his exfiltration, a gathering was held at Century House, to which representatives of all the intelligence services were invited, along with selected government officials and allies, to examine the Gordievsky Hall and its implications for arms control, East-West relations, and future intelligence planning. The hundreds of individual reports were piled up on a single conference table, like a huge buffet, over which the assembled spies and spymasters browsed and gorged for 2 solid days. In Britain, MI6 bought a house for him in the London suburbs, where he lived under a false name. MI6 and MI5 took the death threats seriously. He gave lectures, listened to music, and wrote books with the historian Christopher Andrew, works of detailed scholarship that still stand as the most comprehensive accounts of Soviet intelligence to date. He even gave television interviews, disguised in a faintly absurd wig and false beard. The KGB knew what he looked like, but it was not worth taking chances. As Gorbachev's reforms began to sweep the Soviet Union and the communist empire started to totter, his expertise was ever more sought after. In May 1986, Margaret Thatcher invited him to Chequers, her official country residence. For nearly 3 hours, she interviewed the man she had known as Mr. Collins on arms control, Soviet political strategy, and Gorbachev. In March 1987, he briefed her again, this time in Downing Street, before she made another successful visit to Moscow. The same year, he met Ronald Reagan in the Oval Office, where they discussed Soviet espionage networks and posed for the cameras. The meeting lasted 22 minutes, 4 minutes longer, Gordievsky gleefully noted, than the Labour leader, Neil Kinnock, had enjoyed with the leader of the free world. "We know you," said Reagan, putting an arm around the Russian's shoulder. "We appreciate what you've done for the West. Thank you. We remember your family and will fight for them." For the first years of liberty, he was exceedingly busy, but often profoundly miserable. Gordievsky's family remained captives of a vengeful KGB. In a recurrent dream, he saw his wife and daughters returning at the arrivals hall in Heathrow to a joyful reunion, only to wake up to the knowledge that he was alone. In Moscow, Leila lived under effective house arrest, kept under close surveillance in case she, too, somehow managed to flee. Her telephone was tapped. Her letters were intercepted. She could not find a job and depended on her parents for support. One by one, her friends seemed to melt away. There was an absolute vacuum. Everyone was frightened to see me. I changed the children's names to Aliyev, because Gordievsky is such a distinctive name. My daughters would have been ostracized. She stopped cutting her hair and declared she would not cut it again until she was reunited with her husband. When, years later, she was asked by a journalist how she felt when she heard he had defected to Britain, she said, "I was simply glad to know he was alive." Under the terms of Gordievsky's conviction for treachery, their combined property was confiscated. Flat, car, luggage, and the video recorder brought from Denmark. The camp bed with the holes in the mattress, the iron. They especially liked the iron because it was an imported one. "A Hoover," Leila said. Gordievsky tried to send her telegrams, but these never reached her. He bought presents, including expensive clothes for the girls, which he lovingly wrapped and sent to Moscow. All were seized by the KGB. When a letter finally arrived from Leila, he read the first few lines and realized it had been dictated by the KGB. "They've forgiven you," she wrote. "You can easily get another job." Was this plainly a trap to lure him back? Was she conspiring with the KGB? He managed to smuggle a letter to her, through a Soviet official, in which he stuck to the claim that he was the victim of a KGB plot, perhaps thinking this would protect her. Leila was appalled. She knew it was not true. "He told me, 'I'm not guilty of anything. I'm an honest officer, I'm a loyal citizen,' and so on, and I had to flee abroad. Why he lied to me again, I don't know. It was surreal. I tried to understand. There were some words about the children, and he said he still loved me, but I thought, 'You did what you wanted to do. I am still here with the children. You ran, but we are prisoners.'" They were deceiving each other. Perhaps they were deceiving themselves. The KGB told Leila that her husband was having an affair with a young English secretary. Leila was informed by the KGB that if she formally divorced Gordievsky, her property would be returned, including the iron. "They said I should think of the children." She agreed. The KGB sent a taxi to take her to the divorce court and paid the divorce tax. She reverted to her maiden name. She believed she would never see him again. "Life went forward," she said. "The children went to school. They had some joy. Never did I dare to cry in front of my children or show what was in my soul. I always had a proud mind and a smile on my face." But she told a sympathetic Western journalist, who managed to secure a brief interview, that she still loved her husband and longed to be with him. "Even if I am not his wife on paper, I am still his wife in spirit." The campaign to get the family out continued for 6 years, relentlessly and fruitlessly. "We tried to approach them through the Finns and Norwegians, but we had no cards," said George Walker, the MI6 officer in charge of Operation Hetman, and now one of Gordievsky's main points of contact with the service. "We spoke to people in neutral countries and human rights people. We got the French, the Germans, the New Zealanders, everybody, to organize and try to build pressure for their release. The Foreign Office was constantly bringing it up through the ambassadors in Moscow." When Margaret Thatcher met Gorbachev in March 1987, she immediately raised the issue of Gordievsky's family. Charles Powell observed the Soviet leader's reaction. He went white with anger and refused to respond at all. They would meet twice more over the coming years. On both occasions, Thatcher raised the matter again and was rebuffed. But it didn't deter her. It never did deter her. The KGB would not relent. "Oleg has made absolute fools of them," said Walker. "The only punishment they could inflict on Oleg was not to let his wife and children go." 2 years after the escape, a letter from Leila arrived in London, brought out by a Finnish truck driver who posted it to London from Helsinki. The letter, in Russian on 3 pages of foolscap, was not written under KGB direction. It was honest and furious. Walker read it. It was the letter of a very strong, able, very angry woman, saying, "Why didn't you tell me? How could you abandon me? What are you doing to rescue us?" Any hope that the story might have a fairy tale ending began to fade. Betrayal, extended separation, and KGB misinformation had eroded what little marital trust remained. Occasionally they managed to make telephone contact, but the conversations were strained, as well as overheard and recorded. The girls were shy and monosyllabic. The stilted exchanges on a crackling line seemed only to magnify the distance, both physical and psychological. Walker observed, "I knew from the start it wasn't going to be an easy reconciliation. It would have been extraordinarily difficult under any circumstances. But once I'd read the letter, it was clear that it was very unlikely that there was going to be a reunion." Operation Hetman continued nonetheless. My job was to make sure that we still remembered this woman. The escape had stunned and deeply embarrassed the KGB, but the heads that rolled were, as always, the smaller ones. Nikolai Grybin, Gordievsky's immediate boss, was demoted, even though he had no responsibility for what had happened. Vladimir Kryuchkov, the head of the first chief directorate, became chairman of the KGB in 1988. As his deputy, Viktor Grushko rose with him. Viktor Budanov, who had led the investigation, was appointed head of Directorate K and rose to the rank of general. After the collapse of communism, Budanov founded Elite Security. In 2017, it was announced that Elite had won a $2.8 million contract to guard the U.S. Embassy in Moscow, an irony that amused Mikhail Yubimov, who pointed out that the Russian Embassy in Washington would be quite unlikely to hire a company with links to the CIA. The Berlin Wall, the barrier that had triggered the first stirrings of rebellion in Gordievsky, came down in 1989, following a wave of anti-communist revolutions in Eastern and Central Europe. With Glasnost and Perestroika, the KGB began to loosen its grip on the disintegrating Soviet Union. The hardliners of the Kremlin were increasingly unhappy with Gorbachev's reforms, and in August 1991, a group of plotters, led by Kryuchkov, attempted to seize power. He doubled the pay of all KGB personnel, ordered them back from holiday, and placed them on alert. The coup collapsed after 3 days. Kryuchkov was arrested, along with Grushko, and charged with high treason. Gorbachev moved quickly against his enemies in Soviet intelligence. The KGB's 230,000 troops were placed under Defense Ministry control. Directorate K was disbanded, and most of the top leadership was fired, with the exception of Gennady Titov, now a general. The crocodile happened to be on holiday when the coup was launched and was promoted to head of counterintelligence. "Spying has become much harder than it used to be," he said wistfully, a few days after the attempted putsch. Kryuchkov was replaced by Vadim Bakhatin, a democratic reformer who set about dismantling the vast espionage and security system that had terrorized the Soviet Union for so long. "I am presenting the president with plans for the destruction of this organization," said Bakhatin. The new head of the KGB would also be its last. One of his first acts was to announce that the Gordievsky family would be reunited. "I felt it was an old problem, which should be resolved," said Bakhatin. "When I asked my generals, they all categorically said no, but I decided to ignore them and regard this as my first major victory in the KGB." Leila Alieva Gordievsky and her daughters Maria, Masha, and Anna landed at Heathrow on September 6, 1991, and were flown by helicopter to Fort Monckton, where Gordievsky was waiting to take them home. There were flowers, champagne, and presents. He had tied yellow ribbons, the American symbols of homecoming, throughout the house, bought fresh new linen for the girls' beds, and turned on every lamp to create a cheerful blaze of light. 3 months after the family was reunited, the Soviet Union was dissolved. The newspapers published posed photographs of the family, strolling happily through London, a picture of domestic harmony and the power of love at a time of tumultuous political upheaval in Russia. Here was a convenient, romantic symbol for the end of communism. But after 6 years of enforced estrangement, there was also deep pain. Masha, now aged 11, barely remembered her father. To his 10-year-old younger daughter, Anna, he was a stranger. Oleg expected Layla to slot back into the marriage just as before. He found her critical and hostile, demanding explanations. He accused her of making the children deliberately dependent on her. For Layla, the return to Britain was just the latest chapter in a story